We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Robert Wirth. He's a reporter for the New York Times who covers the Middle East. And we'll be talking about the politics of Yemen and trying to get a better understanding of why this country, which is the poorest in the Middle East, has become a base of operations for militants. In a recent issue of the New York Times magazine, Wirth explores the possibility that Yemen could become the next big challenge for the United States, much like Afghanistan is now. Robert Wirth has been working for the Times since 2000. In October 2007, it was announced that he'd become a Middle East correspondent for the paper. Before that, from 2003 until 2006, he worked as a correspondent in Baghdad for the New York Times. And continues to write regularly for the paper. We're talking this morning with Robert Wirth by telephone, so he's joining us that way. You can do the same. We certainly welcome questions, but please make them questions. Try to keep them brief and try to keep it on the topic, and that'll make enough room for as many different people as want to be involved in the conversation. So if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also send your questions by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point, questions are welcome. And Mr. Wirth, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, nice to be with you.
We appreciate it. You know, it seems to me that, say, before last December, Yemen wasn't getting a lot of attention, at least in the American media, and that really changed when there was an attempted bombing of a U.S. airliner. This was on Christmas Day last year, and a branch of al-Qaeda based in Yemen said that they were involved in this. So people started to hear more about Yemen. How much attention, say, before that was the administration paying to Yemen?
I think the attention had really ramped up gradually. It started, of course, with the Cole bombing in 2000, when 17 American sailors were killed in the Yemeni port of Aden in the south. An FBI team went over there and an investigation. And even then, though, it was unclear. You didn't hear a lot about it in the U.S., really, beyond the initial weeks after that. Of course, then after 9/11, there was a lot of concern about Yemen, just because it's been a base for a lot of jihadism. And a lot of people who had fought in the Afghan jihad in the 80s ended up in Yemen afterward. So it was a concern, and in fact, one of the first major strikes in 2002, where an al-Qaeda operative was taken out successfully, was in Yemen. You had then sort of a period of relative quiet, but over the past 2 or 3 years, the administration has grown increasingly concerned because al-Qaeda in Yemen has gotten stronger and stronger and more and more ambitious, mm-hmm. carried out more and more attacks on embassies and other targets. And that really began to pump up in January 2009 when they expanded their operations and put out a lot of publicity material, and a couple of the former Guantanamo detainees who've been released ended up in this video declaring themselves to be, members of al-Qaeda, and that was an embarrassment, obviously, for the administration.
And that was at a time when the administration had been talking for some time about closing down Guantanamo, and I think that it is the case that a lot of the people there who are being held at Guantanamo, maybe close to half or a little under half, are from Yemen.
That's right. It's the largest single national group is Yemeni.
Yeah.
Of course, what happened with the attempted Detroit bombing put a complete freeze on plans to repatriate a lot of those Yemenis, even though many of them were deemed to be harmless.
You talk about Yemen in the piece that was just published recently in the Times and make it sound like a pretty wild place. Certainly there are a lot of people, a lot of men with guns. There seem to be around the country a number of small independent power centers, at least where there is some local person who has control over his area. It has a weak central government. It doesn't seem to really have a lot of authority outside of the Capitol, it really, at least in a superficial way, the more and more you talk about it, begins to sound more and more like Afghanistan.
I think it may end up eventually like Afghanistan, but it's definitely not right now. I mean, you don't have a big ideological movement like the Taliban, and the government is more or less in control in all the major urban areas. In the rural areas, the outlying areas, which are pretty inaccessible often, there's mountains, there's deserts, areas with very few roads. Those are the places that are very hard to control, because not just because of the topography, but because tribes are very powerful there, and many of the tribes don't have ideological differences with the government. It's not like you'll find a tribe that is an Al-Qaeda tribe. It's just that they live in very poor areas, so they're very pragmatic, and they've tended to sort of choose sides based on who would favor them the most, pay them the most money, give them the most benefit.
And it sounds as if they if there would be any sort of relationship between a tribe like that and a group like Al-Qaeda, it might not necessarily be on an ideological basis, but if these people felt that the Al-Qaeda guys were sort of on the outs with the government, then if they don't feel any particularly strong attachment to the government, so there could be that kind of alliance, or at least they would welcome them into their local territory simply because they were opponents of the government.
Exactly. They have the same enemy to some extent. I think you'd again find very few who are sort of really true believers, but they have sympathy because, after all, these guys are often angry at the government. Their relationship with the government shifts. I mean, the government will sometimes make a settlement that'll make them happy, and then they'll shift sides and be with the government. But most of the time, they tend to feel that they're being mistreated, so they're generally against the government. And of course, in the Arab world in general, there's a lot of anger at the United States, which is seen as backing Israel. So that part of Al-Qaeda's agenda is very popular.
Mm-hmm. It seems that many people, Yemeni people that you talk to, they feel very connected to the place where they live. As far as they're concerned, the ruler is the local sheikh. They don't seem to have much connection with the central government. Many people don't seem to have much connection to the idea of being a citizen of Yemen.
Well, I think that's relatively rare. In my article, I mentioned that there was an area that's heavily controlled by this one sheikh who's notorious in Yemen. There may be a couple of other areas like that, but I think for the most part, Yemenis are aware of where they are.
Hmm.
Or that is to say, they're aware of their government. I mean, Yemen is, an ancient civilization. 2,000 years ago, it was considered one of the most prosperous parts of the region. Most Yemenis also are very, very conscious that in 1962 there was a revolution which was Republican in nature. So you'll hear a lot about the revolution. What that means to them was that the old social order, or by most of Yemen, or at least northern Yemen, was ruled by this religious ruler called an imam. That era is over. There's a clean break in 1962. I think even rural Yemenis are aware of that.
Perhaps we could talk a little bit more about the historic background here, historical background, at least going back to the point where the country, which at one time was really two countries, unified, and that was in 1990.
That's right. Before that, there was a period when the South was communist. Of course, up until 1967, for 130 years or so, it was much of the South was a British colony. It's a sort of matter of definition here. The British started out just in one particular part of the South called Aden, the port town. They gradually sort of incorporated spheres of influence throughout the South. But in 1967, they withdrew, and soon after that, you had a sort of hardline Marxist faction that took over and declared a communist state in South Yemen, which received a lot of support from Soviet Union, military and otherwise. Now, when the Soviet Union began to fall apart, it became clear that this country was not going to be very viable. So that was a big motive for the unification in 1990. However, the unification was handled very quickly and without a lot of planning. And what you hear in the South a lot is that despite the excesses and the sort of economic mismanagement under the communist period, there were also some social advances. I mean, for instance, child marriage was ended, and the communist rulers tried very hard to sort of get rid of some of the older tribal practices and to make it more of a real state. And many people in Yemen, in South Yemen today, are nostalgic for those things. Many, even in fact, will talk about how they wish the British would come back, which is pretty shocking to hear as an American. But in 1990, the two countries unified. After that, there was some discontent in the South. There was a feeling that the North had sort of stomped all over the South and sort of, you know, taken over, taken its resources away. A lot of the oil in Yemen is in the South. And so by 1994, that was resulted in a civil war, a brief civil war, which the North won. And ever since then, the South has, many people in the South have felt that they are sort of the weaker partner, or even sort of many people will even say they're being occupied by the North. And in the past 3 years, that has resulted in a growing movement that has, for many of its, many people simply are unhappy with what's happening in the South. But I would say that the vast majority of them now are calling for secession.
And I think that it's also, in addition to that, there are groups in the North that have been fighting with the government. So on both sides, both North and South, there are challenges to the government. Dealing with that has been, for the government, very expensive. And I think still today there is, as you say, there is unrest in both of these parts of the country.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, in the North, there's been a sort of insurgency that is armed, and it's really a war that has gone on intermittently since 2004, which is totally different from what's going on in the South. There was a truce declared, really a sort of what seemed like a firmer truce than any of the ones we had seen before in February of this year. But in the past few weeks, the violence has broken out again up there. And in the past, really just in the past week or so, it's gotten much worse. And now people really fear that that we'll have once again a full-scale war in the North, which, as you say, drains the government's resources and makes it harder for them to fight al-Qaeda, which is what West generally wants the Yemeni government to focus on.
Mm-hmm. Well, we touched on that maybe a little bit already, but once you, when you leave the capital and its province, how much control, let's say outside of the major urban areas, how much control does the government have?
Well, you'll see checkpoints all around the capital and all around the major cities. You'll see, in major provincial towns, you'll certainly see soldiers and police. But I think certainly in the outlying areas, the tribes are the ones who really are in charge. And so if the government, for instance, wants to capture a particular person or bring him in, they usually have to work out some kind of deal with the local tribe. And that might involve simply a visit or courtesies. It might involve, some kind of essentially deal where they agree to pay something or to build more schools, that kind of thing. It might just be that President Saleh makes some calls and puts some pressure on local people. But, for instance, the American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki is now in the mountains of Shabwa province, which is southeast of Yemen's capital. And as we know, the Americans are trying to kill him. The Yemeni government, it says, is trying to capture him and bring him in, but they've been unable to do so because he is being protected by his tribe. So there you have an example where the government is not in control.
It seems, though, also that if you look at the strategy that the president and his government have employed for staying in power, it seems that it's very much been they've had a kind of a philosophy that says, well, if people out of the countryside are busy fighting each other, well, then they won't be fighting with us. And that it seems that the president has long favored this strategy of keeping his political opponents fighting with each other, keep the opposition or any threat divided and at each other, and then that means then they won't be threatening the government.
That's right. That's right. This is an old strategy. God knows it. It's all over the Middle East, and not just the Middle East. I mean, I'm sure it's probably mentioned in Machiavelli. I think President Saleh has been more effective with those kinds of strategies, and his goal always been has to keep the country in general stable and to stay in power, which some would say, you know, is absolutely worth whatever costs you pay, because before him there were short-term presidents who were knocked out by rivals, but there's no question that he encourages. He has encouraged over the years various local animosities. In some cases, he has, for instance, when a particular tribe or group was resisting him or not giving him what he felt he needed, he would create a clone, as it were, of that group, or pay its rivals so as to create more conflict and prevent these guys who were opposing him from.
Yeah. One of the things I think you point out in the piece is that the president, when he took power, when he became president, no one, and I suppose this was based on past history, no one really expected him to last that long, and here he is. It's been 30 years.
That's right. So, you know, he's become someone who's really indispensable to the country because he's been in power so long. He has relationships with absolutely everybody. And one of the interesting things you sometimes hear from really strong critics of President Saleh is that they don't want him to. I mean, the ideal thing, they say, would be not to knock him out and bring someone else in, but rather to persuade him to adopt a different style of governing, because he's the one guy who has the connections and the history and the ability of clout to carry this stuff out.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Robert Wirth. He is a correspondent in the Middle East for the New York Times, also spent a number of years as the Times Baghdad correspondent. And we're talking about Yemen, a country that he's continued to write about for the paper. In fact, he wrote a major article about Yemen that appeared in the New York Times Magazine in the July 11th edition. So I'm sure you can go back and take a look at it and see some more recent reporting as well in the paper. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Something that you certainly make mention of, and you see a lot in articles about Yemen, is the economic reality that is in place there. Here we have a place where the economy is built on oil, but I think the thought is that it's running out. It is a very poor country. It's the poorest in the Arab world. Most of the population is under 30, and it's expected to double in the next 20 years. They're also running out of water, and some people think that it might, in fact, be the first, that Sana'a may be the first modern capital city ever to run out of water. How does that all affect the political atmosphere?
Yeah, well, I mean, a number of people speculate that President Saleh is losing what he needs in terms of resources to maintain control of the country, and there's worry that his authority might break down. They are building a big natural gas pipeline that they hope will replace some of the disappearing oil, but it's not going to bring in anything like the revenues that oil had brought in. As for the water situation, it's deeply frustrating to Yemeni officials as well. Part of it is a matter of poor administration. Even if you have sort of the right policies in the capital, something like 70% of Yemenis live in the countryside. And getting the message out and getting people to adopt the right practices is very difficult. What they have been doing with water is drilling. And these great big drills that go down, you know, hundreds of meters into the ground and tap the groundwater. And the groundwater is rapidly, rapidly receding. You know, the farmers had tended to view this once they started bringing in drills in the 60s and 70s as a sort of, permanent resource. And they stopped doing the older methods of rainwater collection that had been relied on for thousands of years. So the hope of many NGOs that are working on this issue is to bring back those older methods and to eradicate the drills. But unfortunately, there's no sign of that happening.
The United States has tried to support the president, President Saleh, and his government, and they have done it by providing humanitarian aid, but also by trying to provide some sort of military support for him to go after al-Qaeda. That's really one of the things that the United States really wants is for the government of Yemen to put pressure on al-Qaeda there. So we're trying to offer some assistance there, but also we are providing humanitarian aid. And I think that the number that I saw was something over $42 million. What exactly is the United States trying to do in Yemen?
Well, as you said, I think the highest priority right now is military and intelligence. They want to make sure that anyone who's trying to plot attacks on American targets in Yemen or American targets or Western targets abroad is stopped. And so they're working with the Yemeni military and security services to get these people before they can act. You saw a whole number of airstrikes beginning in December of last year. They were geared to that end. Now, as you say, they talk to U.S. officials about this. They understand that you've got to have a longer-term strategy that's about fighting economic problems, corruption, all these kinds of things, building up a better administration. But these are really, really tough issues to deal with. There's a history of tremendous difficulty getting them done. Now, in the past, Yemen wasn't a high priority for the United States. And when it did become a priority, it was really pretty narrowly focused to military issues. Also, you have to remember that Yemen is sort of a junior partner in a sense, or it's seen that way, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is much, much bigger. It's just to the north. And Saudi Arabia has often pretty much always seen Yemen as its sphere of influence, its neighbor. And they don't feel comfortable, Saudi rulers, with the United States and Western countries taking a strong hand in terms of Yemen policy. So those are all obstacles to longer-term goals.
Maybe talk maybe a little bit more about the involvement of the Saudi government in Yemen. It seems that there has long been this relationship. After all, Saudi just north of Yemen, that's Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis are certainly interested, feel they have security interests here. Now the president, Mr. Saleh, actually backed Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War, so that soured relations with Saudi Arabia. And since that time, I think some people have described this relationship as being in a rebuilding phase. What are the Saudi goals in Yemen, and in what way have they been involved in Yemen?
Well, what you often hear people say is that Saudi Arabia wants to keep Yemen weak, but in other words, they wanted to keep it somewhat unstable. But if it gets too unstable, they get frightened. Now, this is obviously not coming from them. This is what you hear people say in Yemen. They view Yemen as sort of a potential threat to them. Not just because of the chaos that comes out of it and so forth, but because it is nominally a democracy and they have regular elections. For an absolute monarchy like Saudi Arabia, that's sort of a political idea that they're not so keen on. They don't want to see that spread. But historically, Saudi Arabia has made payments to powerful Yemeni tribal sheikhs, especially the ones in the north who are closer to them, because they want to maintain some control over that country, which, as you said, has a weak central government. This has certainly helped Saudi Arabia to get what it wanted, but it's also been difficult for Yemen because if you have the neighbor passing off large payments, it makes it even harder to create a real state and exercise control over your territory. I think more recently the Saudis have become concerned with the growth of al-Qaeda. And it's important to say that one of the things that has happened in the past couple of years is that the al-Qaeda in Yemen has added Saudi members. In fact, some of these people seem to be playing some of the most powerful roles. These are people often who were forced out of Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia itself had huge battles with al-Qaeda members who were trying to fight the Saudi security services who clearly wanted overthrow the Saudi government. The Saudis did a very good job of kicking those people out, killing them. They have a very strong now internal counterterrorism program. But some of those people simply slip across the border, which is quite porous, to Yemen. And now one of the things that the Yemen branch, which is actually not just the Yemeni branch, they call themselves Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula. They're a merger of the Saudi and the Yemeni branch of Al-Qaeda.
Hmm.
And one of their main goals is to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia.
How closely connected is the Al-Qaeda in the Persian Gulf with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
It's an interesting question. One of the things that alarmed Americans and sort of led to an increase in the number of American trainers and American military assistance generally to Yemen last year was reports that you had jihadists from Pakistan-Afghanistan area as well as East Africa coming into Yemen, and that there was sort of communication back and forth. And certainly Ayman Zawahiri, the number two in the main original Al-Qaeda branch, frequently talks about what's going on in Yemen. He gave his seal of approval, for instance, in, I believe it was late 2008, when a new leader was named for Al-Qaeda's Yemeni branch. He publicly said, "I approve of this guy." So I think it's not as though you had a sort of clear branch of a single company where Osama bin Laden's at the top and these guys listen to orders. I mean, they are based in Yemen and they've got their own priorities, but there are definitely strong ties.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Robert Wirth. He works for the New York Times, has been since the fall of 2007 a Middle East correspondent for the Times. Before that, he was also a correspondent for the Times in Baghdad. He was the Baghdad correspondent for the Times from 2003 until 2006 and has been with the paper since 2000. And we're talking this morning about Yemen. He's done a lot of writing about Yemen. He wrote a major piece for the New York Times magazine that appeared in the July 11th issue, which you can take a look at, and continues to write about the region for the paper. And we're talking about Yemen and its politics. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked just a bit ago about maybe one relatively recent significant development was the development of this merged organization involving Al-Qaeda from Yemen and Al-Qaeda from Saudi Arabia, this new organization calling itself Al-Qaeda in the Persian Gulf.
In the Arabian Peninsula.
In the Arabian Peninsula. And there was Al-Qaeda in Yemen before that, how long has Al-Qaeda had a presence in Yemen? And let us say prior to this affiliation with the Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, how strong was Al-Qaeda in Yemen?
Well, the first time that it became known as an organization that was attacking Western interests was with the attack on the USS Cole in 2000. Before that, there were certainly people who were calling themselves Al-Qaeda, but they were not attacking anything. They were not attacking the Yemeni government. They were not attacking U.S. Bases or of any kind, so that there wasn't a sense that they were Al-Qaeda. However, there certainly were lots of jihadists in the country from going way back. There was also an attack much earlier, in the early 90s, in Aden in the south, on a hotel where some American soldiers were staying. Ended up not killing American soldiers. So clearly there, there have been people coming in and out with an interest in attacking Americans going back to the early 90s. That was shortly after the American involvement in Somalia, and those soldiers were on their way, I believe, to Somalia at the time.
Well, you noted that as far as the Al-Qaeda from Saudi Arabia were concerned, that one of their official and stated goals was to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia. For Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Do they posed a threat to the government of Yemen?
They do. They do. They absolutely do. I think the Yemeni government didn't see them as a threat until more recently, because after all, in the coal attack, that was an attack on an American ship. And in the years afterward, especially once the Iraq War began, there was a great deal of sympathy in Yemen, as in other Arab countries, for Iraq, a feeling that it was unjustly being attacked by an occupying foreign power. And so there were Yemenis who were, you know, training to become suicide bombers or fighters in Yemen and then going off to Iraq. Now, the government publicly, you know, would not, certainly not endorse or approve any such thing. But neither was it a big threat to them. And, you know, it was against their interests to act decisively against jihadists in Yemen, because these powerful people had a pretty powerful constituency and they had some public support. There were radical clerics who were, if not actually out, you know, calling for such things, then they approved of them. And as a politician who needed to, you know, keep his political base, President Saleh was not going to go out railing against this kind of thing. That began to change when you had a new generation of al-Qaeda coming in, which was not simply, you know, focused on going out and fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that, but began to openly see Yemeni government as an infidel government, one that was supported by the United States, because after all, remember, starting in 2001, President Saleh made very clear that he was going to support the United States in its counterterrorism efforts. So you had a new generation that suddenly turned on the Yemeni government, or I should say gradually turned on them, and began to attack them, began to kill, you know, began to target Yemeni army patrols, compounds, that kind of thing. As well as attacking Western embassies in the Yemeni capital, which is not something that the Yemeni government can tolerate either. So, you know, at that point you had a stronger response of the Yemeni government to al-Qaeda inside Yemen. However, there was also a tendency to negotiate, which the Americans were very concerned about. In some cases, there were even people who had been indicted or convicted of roles, for instance, in the coal bombing, who were paroled in Yemen. Now, the Yemenis say this is their way of dealing with it, that you know, you can put someone in prison for a while, but once you get the agreement of his tribe that he will renounce violence, they would sometimes release him and put him under house arrest. And they would say, frankly, this is a much, much better way of keeping the lid on things. It's consistent with their culture and the way they do things. That again, raised hackles among American officials. But things began to change again in 2008 and 9. September 2008, you had a really big attack on the U.S. embassy. It killed a bunch of Yemeni guards. And you had in 2009, again, the sort of a big stepping up in the publicity of al-Qaeda, very, very publicly saying, we are going to take down the government of Ali Abdullah Saleh. And then in the fall of 2009, the American officials went to President Saleh and showed him irrefutable evidence that al-Qaeda was targeting him and his family. So it was at that point that you saw, according to what I've been told, a really decisive shift where Saleh, you know, there were no more negotiations, there was no more sort of back-and-forth talk. There was a sense that he was much, much firmer in his commitment to fighting al-Qaeda.
And I think that's interesting, because I think that there are some people who made this criticism, and this may be more true of going back a little further, but people who said, well, really, that President Saleh had made a kind of a deal with al-Qaeda and had said to them, as long as you don't threaten me, as long as you don't carry out any attacks in Yemen, basically we'll leave you alone.
Yeah, I think that was true. Again, in that period when al-Qaeda was clearly present in Yemen, but was more focused on, you know, sending people to Iraq or what have you. That's what I meant when I said that, you know, for Saleh, the political costs were very high of going after those people at that time. So he basically had a deal, you know, an unwritten deal with them, that he would tolerate them or not act strongly against them as long as they did not target him. But that changed. They did begin to target him. Now, the problem also is that, well, he, you know, his the top level of his government, began to have a very strong commitment to going after al-Qaeda, and you had American trainers going in and creating this highly skilled counterterrorism force. You have a large security bureaucracy in Yemen, and some of these guys have sympathy for al-Qaeda. So, it's difficult in a country as sort of complicated as Yemen to get a single unified effort, very, very quickly. So there's been a couple of incidents. For instance, one notorious one in February 2006, we had 23 high-level prisoners, al-Qaeda guys mostly, who escaped from a prison in the capital. And it's believed that members of Yemen's security services helped this to happen. Now they've made efforts to reform the security services. They've sort of downgraded the organization that was said to involve a lot of sympathizers, and they've created a new one. But that effort is continuing.
Our guest in this part of Focus, let me just introduce again, is Robert Wirth. He's a correspondent in the Middle East for the New York Times. Also, from 2003 to 2006, he was the Baghdad correspondent for the Times. He's done a lot of writing about Yemen, including a major piece that was published recently in the New York Times magazine. And we're talking about Yemen and its politics. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We are coming into about our last 15 minutes of the program. A little bit earlier, we talked about the fact that say, in some of the more remote tribal areas of the country, that al-Qaeda can be there, and that while there may not necessarily be an ideological common ground between local people and al-Qaeda, the one thing that they might share would be a sort of a disdain for or disregard for the power of the central government. So that would certainly be one reason why local people wouldn't chase the al-Qaeda out. But al-Qaeda also... there are some places where they actually have been involved in trying to do things to get support of the local people. What sort of things has al-Qaeda done to try to get popular support?
Well, they have, these are very poor areas that have long had grievances against the government because they say they don't have any support. I mean, they don't have schools, or even if they do have schools, they don't have teachers. They often lack hospitals, or again, in places where someone has come in and built a hospital, it may be understaffed or have no staff at all, so they're willing to go to anyone who's willing to help them. It's hard to know how frequent these episodes are, but I certainly know of some cases in which al-Qaeda has offered to bring in teachers. They've also offered to mediate disputes, which is an important element because the tribal disputes happen all the time in rural parts of Yemen, and some of these members of al-Qaeda present themselves as people with religious credentials. Their knowledge of the Quran, they'll say, makes them capable of playing this role of intermediary. And that is one of the ways they've tried to make themselves acceptable. I think in most areas, this probably doesn't work because people are aware that this, it's a violent extremist agenda. And again, in Yemen, generally, the tribes are not ideological. They're very practical and opportunists. There's a saying that in the 1960s, you had tribes, when there was still a revolution being fought, essentially. There was a war. There was a revolution in 62, but there continued to be battles between the old supporters of the old regime and the new Republican regime. And it was said that many tribes were Republicans by day and royalists by night, based on who was paying them off. So... that is much more common than people who would actually consciously join al-Qaeda's agenda.
Let's talk with someone here. We have a caller in Indiana, Rockville, Indiana, on our toll-free line. We'll go right there. Line 4. Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
I was wondering if your guest could discuss the Yemeni detainees and where they were captured at. That's something I've never really heard about. And if he could discuss the if the security service problem that he had just mentioned would be the problem that we're not returning them to their country.
I'm not familiar with many of the cases of the Yemeni detainees at Guantanamo. I think probably the majority of them were people who volunteered to go and fight in the Afghan jihad, just like many people who fought, you know, all over. But some claim, you know, that they were just there for other reasons. Some claim they were picked up and sold by Pakistanis who falsely said that they were fighting with the Taliban. It's, again, the cases vary. Now, as to why some of them are believed to be hardcore jihadists who could not be safely brought back unless they were kept in prison, as to why they're not being brought back, it's true that I think there are concerns about security in Yemen based on the jailbreaks. But also, you know, there's a concern about how to reintegrate these people into Yemeni society. The Saudis have a well-known and ambitious rehabilitation program for jihadists. And that's been talked about as kind of a model. Yemen actually had its own effort like that began earlier. It was called the Intellectual Dialogue Program. You had a cleric, well-known judge named Mahmoud al-Hitar, who would get groups of jihadists together and talk to them about how, you know, they had a wrong understanding of jihad. And he would sort of set them right about Islam and say, you know, it's a peaceful religion, you shouldn't be doing these things. That program was cut short because it turned out that some of its veterans had, in fact, gone off to Iraq and fought or died as suicide bombers. Other people who went through the program essentially laughed about it and said, you know, all we had to do was sign our names that we went to these lectures and then we got to go free. The Saudi program is much more comprehensive. It's got a psychological dimension. You know, they do all kinds of things. They have art therapy. Residential. It involves the program working with the families of the people in the program to detain, and often providing support to them. I mean, they'll often get these guys, you know, a car or a job, or help them to get married. Really, you know, comprehensively reintegrating them into Saudi society, which, you know, they had a pretty high success rate. There are people who have been through the program who have gone back to Al Qaeda in Yemen. But not very many, and the Saudis rightly say that, you know, overall it's been pretty successful. Yemen is a much poorer country. Coming up with a program like that is much harder.
Okay, I appreciate that. And I was also wondering about the large population bulge that has been discussed with the Middle East. I know Pakistan is one of the largest contributors to the UN peace troops around the world. What are the chances in the future that we could get more Arab nations to contribute and actually help out in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and contribute their own troops that understand the culture better? And I'll take that answer off the line.
All right, thank you.
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't actually honestly know how many peacekeeping troops Arab nations generally contribute. But certainly if they could, you know, have a better cultural understanding of what's going on in some of those conflict areas, that would be great. I'm sorry, it's not something I know.
All right. Well, we're coming down to the point. We have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus, and questions are welcome. Continue to be welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. One thing I wanted to come back to is U.S. policy, U.S. strategy in Yemen, and I think it seems to be the case that in Washington there are people who are concerned that the United States doesn't really have a clear strategy in Yemen. And that's a particular concern because they would say that Al-Qaeda does, but we don't. What are people in Washington now saying about Yemen and this very issue of whether we do or do not have a clear strategy?
Well, I think the trouble is that Yemen is kind of on the back burner now for understandable reasons. I mean, you know, we've had in recent days this huge load of documents about Afghanistan, which has raised fresh doubts about our ability to be successful there, and Pakistan, the role of Pakistan. You, in a sense, you can't blame the U.S. for being distracted by, you know, these more prominent things. I mean, what is going to happen to Afghanistan? What is going to happen to Iraq? They really have to look at those things first. But I think there is a sense among many in the government that they're frustrated that they can't get the political will to try to focus harder on long-term issues, particularly development in Yemen. I mean, most of the experts who really study this feel that, sure, you can use a few drone strikes or what have you to pinpointed strikes to take out some Al-Qaeda leaders, but you've got to accompany that with efforts to reform economy, to look at the corruption issue, look at the administration in Yemen. And I think what's required, unfortunately, is not just a good strategic plan on the U.S. side, but a really coordinated and forceful effort among all the countries that have an interest in Yemen. Now, nominally, there is that. There's a group called Friends of Yemen, which emerged in the wake of the Detroit bombing at Christmas, or the attempted bombing. But, again, you know, the limelight sort of quickly faded away, first because of the earthquake in Haiti, and then because everyone was focusing more on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. And the other problem is that I think you have to have a lot of political will to push Saudi Arabia, which is so influential in Yemen, to get on board with some of these problems. I just think that there hasn't been time and there hasn't been political will to put together a joint effort.
We have another caller in Whiteheath, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'm tuning in on the tail end, but do you see any parallels or comparisons between Al-Qaeda and the IRA and the way that the IRA was eventually assimilated?
Go ahead.
Well, I think it's a tough call. I'm not an expert on the IRA. I know very little about its history, Bill, but I've read in newspapers. I think there are enormous differences because Al-Qaeda is really, you know, focused on sort of eradicating, when they view their opponents, whether Muslim or non-Muslim, as, you know, sort of infidels, and they have a tremendous belief in violence as a way of achieving their goals. Of course, the IRA did too, but Al-Qaeda wants to build an Islamic State and completely eradicate the current order in the Middle East. I think they're more radical and more violent. I mean, as bad as the violence in Northern Ireland was, you didn't have, you know, hundreds of suicide bombers like the ones you had in Iraq and in Afghanistan. So, you know, there has been talk, after all, in Afghanistan of building some kind of government that might include elements of the Taliban. But that's very theoretical at this point, and many people might still view that as a way for the Taliban to kind of get their fingers in and then eventually overturn things completely.
One of the things that I think that people certainly say when they look at Yemen and what the goals of the United States are, they say we really have to be very careful not to act in a way that ends up adding the people of Yemen to the list of America's enemies. And there are some people who say that there are a lot of Yemenis who are already kind of sour on the U.S., and other people that say, well, maybe that the U.S. is not such a bad place, but depending on what we do, that could get worse. That is, the number of Yemeni people who feel negatively about the United States could really increase depending on what it is we do. What could you say, can you say anything about, generally speaking, how people in Yemen feel about the U.S.?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is something that American policymakers are very aware of, and that's why with the recent round of airstrikes, they tried very hard not to, you know, not to announce that they were involved. They want to keep their role as invisible as possible, and to make this a Yemeni operation. I think they would like to get more publicly involved in development efforts and make clear that they're trying to make a difference there. I think animosity towards the United States peaked with the Iraq War. I think that has subsided to some extent. You know, you don't see people going around sort of holding up signs of Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden the way you used to. But I think in the future it's really going to depend on their ability to, A, you know, be precise and carry out airstrikes that don't kill civilians, and B, identify themselves with real efforts to improve the lives of ordinary Yemenis and to improve the economy.
And that's something I think also that I think people who look at U.S. and its involvement in Yemen say, is that one criticism is that we in the United States, we have been too focused on Al-Qaeda, and that really what we have to do is deal with Yemen as an entire country and realize that it's more complex and there's more for us to be concerned with than the presence of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a more integrated, holistic approach is something a lot of people would agree is the right way to go.
Well, just as a way of finishing up, I guess I continue to be drawn back to whoever who decided to, on the piece in the magazine, put this big headline in big type here on the piece, "The Next Afghanistan?" Is it possible at this point to answer a question like, well, is Yemen, how likely is it to become the next Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's a tough call. I think what happens over the next few years will help to determine that. I mean, you know, there are efforts to build a more democratic political future in Yemen, and we'll have to see how those go. There are these conflicts in the north and the south, which continue to provoke unrest and hundreds of thousands of refugees. If those can be settled peacefully in the long term, that will make a tremendous difference. But I think it's a little early to say.
Yeah. Well, our guest in this hour has been Robert Wirth. He is a Middle East correspondent for the New York Times, also served between 2003 and 2006 as the Baghdad correspondent for the Times, continues to write about the Middle East for the paper, including, as I mentioned, this major piece that was in the New York Times magazine a couple of weeks ago about Yemen. You can take a look at that and follow his other work in the paper. And Mr. Wirth, well, thank you very much for talking with us today.